when you have a clear view of what is it that only I can do and what is it that can be handed over, that's a good time to bring a chief of staff in.
Welcome back to Series 11 of 40 Minute Mentor, your pocket-sized career mentor on a mission to raise aspirations and inspire the next generation of category-defining founders. From purpose-led entrepreneurs to world-class investors and Olympians, you'll learn firsthand from today's successful leaders on what it takes to be brilliant, all in just 40 minutes. Today's 40 Minute Mentor is Natasha Ratanshi-Stein, the founder of Surfboard, the next generation planning tools for customer service teams. Before building Surfboard, Natasha spent several years as an operator and investor, including her role as principal at Piton Capital and chief of staff at Bulb. I can't wait to dig more into Natasha's amazing experience to date and all the milestones she's achieved so far with Surfboard, including a 4.8 million euro seed round at the end of 2022 and growing 10x while expanding overseas as well. So, Natasha, welcome to 40 Minute Mentor. It's a real pleasure to have you on the podcast. How are things?
Very good. Thank you, James. I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Honestly, it's a real pleasure. I've heard amazing things about you and the business, so I'm excited to dig more into the story. But we're going to have to warm you up first, as we always like to, with a few quickfire questions. So could you please finish the following sentences after me? Question one, the most memorable day in my career was when?
When Surfboard signed its first customer.
Ah, great answer. When exactly was that in the journey?
That was in February 2021. So I left Bulb at the end of November 2020, raised our pre-seed round in December, January, and then closed our first customer in February. So it all happened quite quickly, but it was very validating that that was the right thing to do.
Yeah, no messing around there then. Incredible. What a start. A very quick start. It reminds me of when I set up JBM. I had not a lot of runway, let's say, and I was sort of going, right, I've got about 3 months to make my first fee before I have to sort of go take out an overdraft and stuff. So yeah, a quick getting started fast is a great way to do it. And as you say, great validation. Question two, one word others would use to describe me is?
Enthusiastic.
Nice. I think others would say that about me too. We have something in common there for sure. I think you need to be enthusiastic to be a founder, right? I think it's kind of par for the course.
Definitely.
My biggest failure to date is?
Not backing myself enough in the early days.
Okay. Interesting. We might have to come back to that one. That feels like a good one to unpack a bit more. I measure success by?
Outcomes.
That seems a very good answer. And if there was one thing that I could change about entrepreneurship, it would be?
Make it easier.
Oh God, yes, that is so true. That's such a good answer. And yeah, it would be lovely if it was easier, wouldn't it? But I guess then everyone would do it. So
that's true.
Yeah, the struggle is real. Awesome. Well, thank you, Natasha. I'm really excited to hear more about Surfboard, but we'll start a bit earlier so we can get to know you and your upbringing a bit more. I think you're originally from Vancouver, is that right, in Canada?
That's correct.
And I am a self-proclaimed lover of Canada. My cousin lives there. I spent lots of time in Canada and love it and love the people. So we're already going to be great friends. But do you mind telling us a bit about your childhood and I guess what ultimately brought you over here to London?
Yeah. So I, as you say, grew up in Vancouver. My parents had a business in the food sector. So they were importers and they had their own brand of spices, rice, canned foods, mostly non-perishables that they imported from India, Pakistan, Thailand, the United Kingdom, etc. I was very exposed to that business from a very young age just because my parents were owner-operators. But I guess at a certain age, I also became quite interested in broadly politics, economics, social sciences. And so when I was around 15 or 16, a family friend asked me about my plans for university. I hadn't refined those thoughts very much yet, but she suggested that I consider the London School of Economics. Once that idea was planted in my head, I just couldn't get it out. And so that was really the driver for me moving to London. I think in addition to that, my family also has a lot of extended family based here in London. So we used to spend a lot of summers here, spent a lot of time. And I don't think there's a better excuse than university to move as far away from home as possible under the guise of education.
Yes, so true. Oh, well, you escaped. And thank goodness you did, because you've had such a stellar career over here. And then you started in investment banking at Goldman Sachs, which is obviously a hugely prestigious firm, before moving into VC at Piton Capital in 2014. So I'd love to know a bit more about what attracted you to VC in the first instance. And like, what impact did that move have on your career?
Yeah, so I was at Goldman Sachs between 2012 and 2014. And what you started to see at a more macro level in those years was Europe and the UK specifically becoming more of a technology hub. Out of Europe, you obviously had businesses like Skype that were successful, TransferWise, or now known as Wise, was becoming a bigger success story, Funding Circle, Farfetch, Just Eat. And so all of those businesses suddenly ended up ones that people at Goldman Sachs were spending a lot of time on pitching for those businesses, whether it was private placements or whether it was the upcoming IPOs. And so the traditional route out of investment banking, and specifically M&A, tended to be private equity or hedge funds. But with a growing ecosystem of startups, scale-ups, and of course the venture capital universe that was funding these startups and scale-ups, there was really a third and fourth route that was developing. And so for me, I think because I was always drawn to the earlier stage businesses as a first point, and second of all, just being closer to what is actually happening in the business as opposed to more the financial engineering side of optimizing a return, VC just stood as something that was really interesting. I think the timing was really interesting. I think the opportunities were really interesting. I met the team at Piton, and at the time, they were just the two founding partners. They were just raising their second fund, which was their first institutional fund. And there was this opportunity, which at the time felt risky, but now that I'm an entrepreneur myself, it was no risk compared to the day-to-day today, of joining them to really be the first boots on the ground and institutionalizing that fund around deal sourcing, around due diligence processes, around deal management, around portfolio management. And it was an opportunity that I really couldn't say no to. And yeah, the rest is history.
Amazing. And sounds like it was a really important sort of part of your career. So what were some of the highlights, the biggest achievements in that time? And I'd also like to know the flip side, if you don't mind, around the harder parts of the role, particularly getting used to working in VC.
Yeah. So I think the best part of working in VC is how intellectually or academically stimulating it is. And so from that perspective, on a day-to-day basis, you're looking at companies across various industries, across various stages with completely different business models, and really understanding what the drivers of success are. And so, you know, having a bit of a checklist to assess how strong is the team, how large is the market opportunity, how strong has their execution been to date, what does their go-to-market look like, how repeatable is that? And I think the most fulfilling part of the job is as you're able to use more and more pattern recognition to be able to identify trends. And one thing that I was quite fortunate at with Piton is that Piton was a fund that focused, or is a fund that focuses just on businesses that benefit from network effects. So marketplaces, exchanges, booking platforms. And so from that perspective, there's a lot of intellectual stimulation that you get from understanding what makes a network effect business successful, how to acquire supply, how to acquire demand, how to make sure that liquidity is built in an efficient way. And I think one thing in that time I was at Piton that made it even more interesting is that, yeah, as I mentioned, the macro was changing. And so you started to see much more inflow of capital go into these businesses than you had seen previously. And with that inflow of capital, it meant that a lot of businesses were buying their way into liquidity. You were seeing much more competitive tension, you know, whether it was businesses like, you know, Deliveroo versus Just Eat versus the other alternatives, Uber Eats, et cetera, or Uber itself versus Lyft versus every other taxi hailing app. And as these businesses were buying liquidity, it really forced discipline on good investors to understand the businesses that had good fundamentals versus the businesses that just had a lot of capital. So I think that was like the good, that was the rewarding. I think it definitely enabled me to flex certain muscles within my brain that I didn't have as much exposure to at Goldman or certainly at university, and think about businesses in a much more critical way, but also a much more holistic way. to answer your question on like the bad or the things that were a lot harder, part of it is that same macro trend that I mentioned, and that VC just became a much more competitive industry. A lot more capital was going into that. And so I think what became a challenge, but also an opportunity, was maintaining discipline in those years. I mean, I say this, and it's funny that I'm saying it despite the fact that I left VC in 2019, and I don't think the market even hit its peak till, you know, post-COVID 2021, but even, you know, 2017, 2018, 2019, the competition around deals was so intense that you really had to think, do I really want this? And how do I make sure I'm not reacting out of FOMO in an industry that can be very driven by that?
Yeah, really interesting. We get a lot of people that listen to this podcast that have aspirations to become a VC. So do you have any advice for them? And is there anything that would have helped you were you to make that move again that you wish somebody had told you?
I probably would have done it the other way around. So as you introduced earlier, I went from VC to Bulb as an operator. And I think I would have been a much more effective VC had I had operating experience before. And I'm not saying that from a box ticking exercise. I'm not even saying it from, you know, an empathy for entrepreneurs perspective. I'm saying it because every business on the surface of it looks like it's running, you know, very well. Everything looks very functional. And it's not until you lift that hood when you realize how hard everything within the business is, like every part of it, whether it's growth, whether it's product, whether it's technology, whether it's financing, all of it is constantly pushing water uphill. And it doesn't take until you're actually in a business to really understand the nuances of it. And I think maybe that's where it ties into empathy for the challenge of running a business. But that's where, as a VC, not only is it that your value add increases quite substantially, but what I mentioned earlier around that pattern recognition, those muscles, I think, would really strengthen with that first-hand experience.
Yeah, really interesting, because it's a perfect segue into my next question, which is that you obviously made the sort of slightly unconventional move of going from investor to operator when you moved the scale up Bulb initially in risk and regulation before becoming chief of staff, which is a very high impact and I'd imagine very challenging but really rewarding role. What was that transition like, and what was it about Bulb that attracted you? I would love to know a bit about your experience, because obviously Bulb, of course, went through highs and lows in the years that you were there.
Yeah. So in terms of making the unconventional move from investor to operator, I was at Piton or NBC for 5 years. And in my third, fourth, and fifth years there, I was spending a lot more time with portfolio companies. And I found that incredibly rewarding. I'd say that in those years, I was definitely enjoying the role the most, but I still felt this itch from being at arm's length with those portfolio companies. You go to a board meeting, you talk about scaling a new channel, you talk about opening a new geography, you talk about a new product offering. But at the end of the day, you could never get into the business and do the execution for them. That was very much something that they would do. They'd come back, they'd report, and you'd really just be at the extreme ends of the feedback loop as opposed to the in-between. And so I think, you know, if you were to ask the partners at Piton, who I worked with very closely, they probably would tell you that from the day they met me, it was probably inevitable that I would have made that decision. You know, as I mentioned, I came from a family that ran their own business. And so there was definitely this entrepreneurial hunger in me. And I think it was just a matter of getting closer to the action. In terms of deciding to join Bulb, there were a couple things. I think, firstly, at the time, so this was March 2019, Bulb was the fastest growing company in Europe. It was adding 40,000 new homes per week as customers. You couldn't walk around London without seeing, you know, their tube ads, their taxi ads, their TV ads. It was just very much in hyperscale mode. And that opportunity in itself really excited me. The second thing is just spending time with the founders. And so you had one founder who was an ex-consultant who had gone into utility companies to try to optimize them and make them better and had seen how broken the industry was. You had another founder who was an energy trader. And so collectively, that combination just showed that they understood the market and saw that opportunity that was ripe for disruption. And then I guess relating to my first point on hyperscaling is that the business at this point was 4 years old. So it wasn't completely, you know, the startup risk that a seed stage business would be. It had raised significant amount of capital. And I thought specifically within that chief of staff role, it would just be a great one where it wasn't so early that everything was being built from scratch, but as it was entering new markets, so it was going into France, Spain, and Texas at the time, there was just a lot of opportunity in that scaling journey to be able to enable the founder to focus on the high leverage tasks that he had to work on whilst really getting my feet quite like in the water on learning to be a solid operator from firsthand access.
Amazing. I mean, what an interesting first experience as an operator to go into company at that stage. And obviously, I was a very happy Bulb customer, but obviously they've had their challenges since. But in some ways, it's the perfect grounding, being that chief of staff to such high profile founders at such an exciting period. I can totally see why you made that move. JBM has specialized in placing chief of staff for many years. We've done a lot of it for lots of different types of companies. And it's often one of the most popular roles that we sort of have an influx of applications for any role that we talk about. So I'd love just to hear your thoughts on why that role was so beneficial for you. And I'd also love to get your advice for anyone listening to this that is kind of, that sounds perfect for me. Like, what can they do to succeed in that role? And what sorts of things should they be aware of?
So at the time, the role was perfect for me because leaving a job in VC as an investor and having been in investment banking before, what I wanted to make sure of is that I didn't end up in a role that was pigeonholed specifically around finance. But I also wanted to go in a role where I could add value from day one. And so understanding, you know, things like finance, things like investor relations, things like fundraising are obviously topics that are top of mind for a founder. And so I think for me specifically, I had really candid conversations with Hayden, the CEO of Bulb at the time, saying, look, I want to add value. I'm very happy to work on this stuff and take as much off your hands as possible. But I don't want this to be the be all and end all of the role because my goal here is really to become a true operator. And so all the stuff that's really messy and ugly in a company, I really want to get my hands dirty with that stuff. I think where it ended up paying off for me is that he definitely heard my concerns and heard my aspirations around the role. And so within the first couple of months, as the company was going through that scaling journey, there were a few challenges. One of them was scaling the customer service operation proportional to growth. It was in that move where he had helicoptered me into working with the customer service operation that I identified the problem that Surfboard is now solving. And then there were other things, right? Like you mentioned, risk and regulatory affairs. As Bulb became the seventh largest supplier in the country, it ended up taking more attention or acquiring more attention from the regulators. And so that became something high impact that, you know, as a CEO, he couldn't spend all his time on, but needed someone who understood his way of working, his operating model, and could be on top of that in a very thorough and fastidious way. And then I think the final part that's like definitely an ugly part of an organization is that, you know, the pandemic hit. And we suddenly had to make sure that people were paying us and paying us the right amount for the energy they were consuming, despite the fact that, you know, all the countries that we were operating in were going through their own financial crises to a certain degree around loss of employment, furlough schemes, et cetera. And so that's when I got helicoptered into the revenue assurance function, really to make sure that we had debt collection and dunning processes in place, and we were doing things like credit checks to avoid revenue leakage from lack of payment. So I think of everything you get from that role, you learn how to become a really good problem solver. Mm-hmm. Nobody who goes into the role thinks, I know what I'm doing, I can solve everything, I'm going to know what the role entails, but every day is extremely different and you just get thrown into anything and everything. And it's very much sink or swim. But I think if you swim, it's extremely rewarding.
Wow. Yeah. That's a fantastic description. Thank you very much. I guess before we come on to talk about Surfboard, which I'm really looking forward to, I just wanted to, maybe for any founders listening to this, I mean, you're a founder now, but you've also been a chief of staff to a founder. So you've seen both sides of this coin. Why should founders consider hiring a chief of staff and what impact can they really have? Because we've seen it be truly transformational for some founders, but we've also seen founders hire they've hired a chief of staff when actually it's not a chief of staff they need, and it's not been the most successful. So yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that where a chief of staff could be most effective is when the founder has a very clear view on where they can have the most leverage on the organization. And so if they have a view of that, look, as a founder, you're doing everything from like sorting out a new office, sorting payroll, sorting the finances, fundraising, setting team culture, setting a product vision, founder-led sales, founder-led content and blog writing. There's like a million things that fall under your remit. And so when you have a clear view of what is it that only I can do and what is it that can be handed over, that's a good time to bring a chief of staff in. And then the second part of the equation is finding, as you say, the right chief of staff. And so what you obviously have to do is have that list very clear in your mind of what it is you can hand over and make sure you're hiring for what can be handed over. And so, you know, for example, if you have a lot of external conversations, let's say that example of risk and regulatory affairs, and you need somebody to deal with the regulator, you need somebody who you trust, who you can put in front of a very high stakes audience. At Surfboard, something I spend a lot of time on is like partnerships. We do a lot of cross-selling with our integration partners. And over time, that's something I would like to hand over. So it's very external facing. You know, there's things like blog writing, which I spend a lot of my time doing, or content creation and thought leadership. Over time, that's something that I would love somebody to understand my tone of voice. I would love them to understand the industry and the value we try to provide in that industry and be able to hand over as much of that as possible. But I think it's really just making sure the founder has a clear view of what they're going to hand over and they're hiring for the skill set, because you can't find someone who like is just good at crunching numbers, but maybe less comfortable speaking publicly or speaking with external parties and then expect them to do everything that you do.
Yeah, really good advice. Thank you very much, Natasha. It's time to go on Surfboard. I'm sure our audience is chomping at the bit to hear more. You set up the business in 2020 and you've already alluded to how swiftly you picked up your first client. But would love to hear a bit more about the ideation, how this came to bear. It sounds like your experience at Bulb was critical to that. And what is Surfboard today and how does it work on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so just a quick introduction to what Surfboard does. We provide workforce management software for customer support teams. So what that means is we forecast the number of tickets, calls, emails they're expecting to receive, and then build the optimal schedule so that they always have enough people online to avoid, you know, you as a customer from having to wait 20 minutes on the phone or a week for an email response, really to match those supply and demand characteristics that exist within a customer service team. So demand being, you know, customer inflow, customer questions, and supply being the capacity or the people they have within their team. Ideation. So as you say, it really was from that experience that I had at Bulb. As I mentioned, I joined in March 2019. At the time, the business was growing like a weed. We had good growth mechanisms. We had price comparison sites on. But the challenge that we had was that our customer support team couldn't keep pace with growth. And so what that translated to practically was that we had long phone wait times. We had a sizable email backlog. We were struggling to ramp the team up to the same productivity that we had seen in the early days. And so, you know, the first few cohorts of customer service team members we had hitting 70 tickets a day, for example, as we started to scale that to, you know, 100, 200 people in customer service, we weren't seeing the same metrics. And so where that became an ongoing concern is, number one, we didn't want to keep our customers waiting. Number two, we knew that we were in an industry where growth was very much dependent on quality of customer service. There's websites that rank customer service performance of energy suppliers, whether it's Which or Uswitch or Citizens Advice. And finally, being in the utility space, it's also a low margin business. And so you can't just keep throwing cost at it. You really have to make sure that those levers towards enhancing productivity are being implemented, because you really have to do as much as you possibly can with the least number of people, but be able to scale that in a way that works for your team and works for your customers. And so it was that exact challenge that, you know, Surfboard aims to solve, ensuring companies can meet their service levels, respond to their customers quickly, but in a way that is fair and balanced to their teams and avoids overstaffing, because that's, you know, a waste of cost, but also prevents understaffing, because that's when you start to build up those queues and backlogs.
Got it. Okay, fascinating. And who is your ideal customer? And what can our listeners, if they go, this is just what I need, what can they expect when they get started?
Yeah. So our ideal customer usually sits across five different industries. E-commerce and retail is big for us. Utilities is big for us. Financial services, given the regulatory pressure and the urgency of demands. Healthcare for the same reasons. Travel and software as a service. I think that's six, my bad. But yeah, six key industries. Typically, they have customer service teams that are 30 people plus. You know, under 30, we obviously will work with them, but typically their needs aren't as complex. They're not quite at breaking point the same way a team reaches when they get to 30 people in customer service. And we integrate with 10 different technology providers. And what we really focus on is bringing your tech stack into a unified view where all your data connects together, as I said previously, to match that supply and demand. So you always know you have the right number of people available to handle the inflow that's coming through, powered by data and powered by insights. In terms of what customers can expect, speedy onboarding, a really delightful ease of use. And I think probably most importantly, the final two things, a guarantee of fairness. We make sure that the schedules attribute tasks in an even and balanced way to avoid burnout, but also to make sure that a team member doesn't feel like they're carrying a lion's share of the work of an organization. And configurability. There's a lot of times a team has to onboard software and completely overhaul their ways of working to make the software work within their construct. That's what I had experienced when I was shopping around for software at Bulb. And it was the exact impetus for wanting to start Surfboard is building it in a much more flexible way. So we are adaptable to the different ways that the teams work.
Love it. And you've already hit some amazing milestones. So I'd love you to share with our listeners some of the biggest highlights from the last few years. And I get also on the flip side, what have been the biggest challenges you've had to overcome?
So I think the most exciting milestones were each month we're signing bigger and bigger customers. And what that does is obviously it puts pressure on our product, but it just raises the bar on how much we're doing and what we're able to serve. These customers put more and more pressure on our product, but it's a good problem to have. And it makes us do better. It challenges us in all the right ways and it gets us into bigger leagues. So I think that's definitely number one. Number two is we're backed by great investors. Our investors have been really supportive, whether it was the pre-seed round, whether it was the seed round. Those were obviously really big milestones for us. Number three is probably the ability to displace competitors, both in processes where we're competing head to head with much more established competitors that have existed for way longer than us, but also just taking customers away from those competitors that have existed longer than us, have raised, you know, 10x more funding than us. So I think that's been quite gratifying and validating of our focus and us putting our energy in the right places. What's been hardest, like a lot is really hard. I'm definitely not going to sugarcoat it. I think the thing that really gets to founders the most is when the team dynamics aren't right. Like you can withstand pretty much anything. You know, you have a lost sale. It feels a bit like a kick to the gut, but you move on the next day. You have, you know, a marketing strategy that goes sideways. And you're like, we just spent $5,000 and got nothing from it. Again, a kick to the gut, but you can move on. I think the stuff that takes a lot of headspace and just ends up living rent-free in your head is when the team dynamics aren't right, whether it's a mishire, whether you feel like you're letting someone on the team down and you want to make sure that they feel rewarded. That stuff is definitely what occupies a lot of my time. And I am, in my spare time, an Arsenal supporter. And so I do watch how different football managers are optimizing their teams and making sure that dynamic feels right. And often try to just replicate that and wonder how you get that right in the company. And so that's the most challenging thing, but it's also the biggest opportunity because that's how you build a successful company.
For sure. And no doubt probably the hardest part is getting hiring right. And as I actually spoke to someone today about this exact topic, and the reality is that we all get it wrong. It's impossible to get it right 100% of the time. And I guess ultimately what you just need to make sure you're doing is learning from mistakes and trying to improve your process and hoping that you get more right than you get wrong. But it is emotionally draining and it's all encompassing. But I guess that's kind of why we're in a job and why I guess it's hard to build exceptional businesses, because those that do crack that, are often the category defining companies. You alluded to the pride with which you, you know, of winning all these fantastic brands. And there are some stellar names that, you know, Bloom and Wild, Beauty Pie, Butternut Box, My Tutor, which is a client of ours. There's so many fantastic companies there. I'd love to know how you got traction so early on with these big companies. And if you have any advice for early stage founders that are trying to sell into B2B customers of a similar scale, like what worked for you? And are there any tips you can pass on to others that might be struggling with this at the moment?
Yeah, so I guess I very much subscribe to the crossing the chasm methodology of really segmenting around who's your early adopter, who's your early majority, at what point are you crossing the chasm? And for each segment of customer that you work with, the approach is really different. So for us, in our earliest customers, you know, I mentioned the first customer we signed at the very beginning, when I was leaving Bulb and I first decided I'm going to start this business, I did probably around like 50 to 60 user research interviews. And what was really validating is out of a few of these user research interviews, people offered. They just said, hey, when you're building a product, we'd love to be just like a beta tester. We need this. We're on spreadsheets right now. And so keen to work with you. And so that's how we ended up formulating our design partner program. And so some of the customers you mentioned, like Bloom and Wild, for example, I met the COO on a user research call and he said, hey, my head of customer service would bite your hand off to be an early customer. And I was like, oh, wow, that's very validating. And so that's how, you know, we ended up working with them. And Bloom and Wild's a great example of a customer that continued to give us feedback and continued to raise the bar for us. And so I remember in our first year of building the product, it was so behind what they expected that one of our engineers just said, can we just get rid of Bloom and Wild as a customer? And it was like, it was the most infuriating comment I had ever heard. It's like, obviously, like, it's such a privilege. They want to work with us. We're not getting rid of them as a customer. But what, you know, one of those points of pride that I now look at is I look at the Slack channel with Bloom and Wild. All the feedback is really good. They've continued to grow with us. They've acquired other brands in Europe. They've added those other brands to Surfboard. And so I think back to, you know, the days when they were less happy with us. I think back to the days when our product team was a little bit frustrated at how much they were raising the bar for us. And yeah, I think a big source of accomplishment for me is that we were able to level ourselves up and meet that high bar. And then I guess like what we did was we worked with like 10 design partners. That gave us, you know, some logos to work with. It gave us people to build the product with. It also gave us a bit of a referral engine to start working with our next set of customers. And I think that's when we started crossing into the early majority category and having to build out, you know, a couple people beyond myself working in sales, but also ensuring that we were very honest about our stage, both in terms of our approach to go to market, but how we work with customers, leaning into the fact that the quality of the customer success you're going to get with us is going to be much more hands-on. We're going to be a lot more agile in terms of roadmap and really take into account feedback. And now we're at a stage where I think we're crossing the chasm again beyond the early majority into like the mainstream. And that's when it's about getting scalable processes that are repeatable, less consultative, more have a clear mechanism for acquire a customer, onboard a customer, serve them well, get them to a healthy account score, get a high CSAT, and just keep repeating that over and over again. But each stage, we've definitely had to adapt.
Incredible. Thank you very much. That's, what a journey. And I love that story about Bloom and Wild. Aaron Gelbard, the founder of Bloom and Wild, came on the podcast before, and I know he has high standards. So exceptional that you have got to where you are now with them, and a great story of perseverance and, you know, resilience as well, and in the face of challenging sort of customer feedback. But that's often what kind of gets you through, doesn't it? It's pushed you on to the next level. Following COVID, the way we work changed forever. For me, for the better. I stopped going into London every single minute of the day and spent a bit more time with the family. But that shift has really inspired you to build Surfboard. And I'd love just to understand just a bit more of your thoughts on it. Remote working and flexible working doesn't work for everyone. But there are all these headlines of companies invasively tracking and monitoring teams. And we've seen burnout, we've seen frustration, we've seen attrition as a result. So where have you seen companies implement more flexible work setups really well? And what advice do you have for any leaders listening to this who are still finding this adjustment quite challenging?
I'd say flexible work for me is divided into two aspects. Number one is, as you say, remote, hybrid, where you work, I guess. And then the second part is when you work. And so within the teams that we work with and, you know, the foundations for starting Surfboard and really thinking about making work more human around fairer scheduling. The nice thing about a customer service team is that if you have the right amount of data, you can facilitate a lot because you have certain inflow patterns. People are calling at a certain time. It's busier on chat at this time. This language is busier at this other time. And so by empowering your team with that data, you can actually enable much greater flexibility because you understand those peaks and troughs, and you can give your teams those visibility of when those peaks need to be staffed for versus when there's a bit more downtime. And so I would say around flexibility pertaining to when people work, and I'm speaking very directly for our target customers, customer service teams, data really wins the battle. Now, outside of customer service teams, so obviously Surfboard itself is a software company. Most of our team is in product right now. It doesn't have those dynamics. I think what's difficult is that in an early stage company, collaboration is essential. Mm-hmm. You need the ability to have impromptu meetings. You need the ability to have casual context. You need the ability to make sure that brainstorming or whiteboarding is as seamless as possible. And look, this isn't the case for every company. There's some companies that have made fully remote work. For us, it's difficult just because of our stage and the need for those three things, the casual context, the ability to brainstorm, and the ability to have those impromptu meetings. And so what we have at Surfboard is the entire company comes in 2 to 3 days a week. I typically go in 5 days a week, but that's just because I end up more productive in the office. For me, I get less burnt out when I'm in the office because I get that change of scenery. The commute really breaks up my day. There's others that are in the office 5 days a week, and I benefit from sparring from them. But there is a lot that comes down to preferences and how specifically teams work, how specifically teams use documentation. But what they can't do is they can't just take the way they were working previously, go to a fully remote environment and expect the same thing is going to work. And all of that casual context, all of that impromptu context or meetings is just going to happen. It has to be deliberately built around structures that facilitate it.
Yeah, that's so true. And what are your predictions for the sort of evolution of how teams are going to work more remotely and collaboratively sort of in 2024 and beyond?
It's really hard to say. I think if you look at a lot of big companies, be it banks, be it law firms, be it big tech, they're now calling people back in 5 days a week. I think especially when you're running at scale, what's really hard is that when you onboard new joiners or you have people in specific functions that require more collaboration, it's really hard to have this like divided approach where, you know, if you're in your first month, you have to come in every day, or if you're an X function, you have to come in every day. And so you can see from an HR perspective why they have to take this blanket approach. And I can understand why they do it. In terms of my predictions, it's really hard to tell, but I think it just comes down to the effectiveness the company has around processes and ensuring, you know, I think you asked me what was the question? How I measure performance?
Yep. How do you measure success?
How I measure success. And I said outcomes. Yeah. And so I think it just comes down to outcomes. I think when you're not seeing outcomes, you need more visibility. Does visibility mean someone being physically in front of you? Probably not. But when you don't have those outcomes, you have to course correct as quickly as possible. And if being in person and just being able to say, hey, what are you working on? Can I see what you're doing? What's the rationale for this? Let's course correct it together. It just can be more efficient in person. But I think every company is going to drive their decision around how they work based on the outcomes they're seeing.
Yeah, totally. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on that, Natasha. That's really, really helpful. We are sadly at an end. We've got three wrap-up questions. I've really enjoyed this chat, but I really want to know the answer to this question. This is 40-Minute Mentor. So if you could be mentored by anyone, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
I'm going to say the most controversial answer, and you might kick me off the show. I would give an arm and a leg to work directly for Elon Musk for 6 months. And it's the same thing as that Blumenwald example where he would just raise the bar so high that I think I would become a superhuman.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I mean, you are not the first person to say Elon, but I guess that answer is maybe a little bit more controversial now than when we first started the podcast based on his various antics.
And just to be clear, I mean, all of his political views, all of that, I don't support.
Totally, yeah. there is no denying his genius. And I guess at the end of the day, if you want to push yourself and learn from somebody that knows how to build incredible businesses, I mean, that would certainly be a very, very interesting experience. And I know that the author of the recent book on Elon Musk spent, I think, 2 years following him around. And God, well, he must have had the most, he must have seen some incredible things. So thank you for your honesty. Our next final wrap-up question is question roulette. So we've told our audience that you're coming on and we have three different questions. So can you choose 1, 2, or 3 and we will see what they have for you?
Three.
Okay. I think you'll be good with this one. As you think about the future, what do you want Surfboard to look like in the next 10 to 15 years?
I'd really like it to be a culture-defining software that changes the way customer service teams work for the better. I think we've been operating in a world for the last, 30, 40 years where customer service teams have been run like burn and churn models. And I think for the teams that don't want to run in that way, they've been orphaned by software. We, want to provide software for those that have felt orphaned around creating balanced cultures that work for their teams and work for their customers. And then B, expand that model so every company can do it without sacrificing their outcomes.
Love that. Thank you very much. A very exciting future ahead, Natasha. This is I'm looking forward to seeing how things evolve from here, but I have no doubt you'll be very, very successful. Our final question is, what one piece of career advice would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Back yourself. Your instincts are usually right. Trust them, follow them. I don't think I did that enough in the early days of Surfboard. And I think, when you ask about the ups and downs, I think those were probably the most costly mistakes. I think as a founder, it's really easy to have imposter syndrome. I was a solo founder. I think the other thing in my situation is that I was a solo founder that is non-technical, building a software business. And so from that perspective, the imposter syndrome was just amplified. And obviously, look, I had a good understanding of the industry. I had a good understanding of our customers. The thing is, your customers are speaking plain English. You're speaking plain English. You're on the same page. But then suddenly, you get reason to doubt your instincts. And yeah, it just usually ends up a mistake when you start doubting them.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for sharing that. I'm sure that is something that a lot of our listeners can relate to, particularly solo founders. I am a solo founder as well, and I totally understand that. So hopefully a really important place to end it for our listeners and a very inspiring conversation. Thank you so much, Natasha.
Thanks, James. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, pleasure. No, we wish you the very best of luck for the year ahead. I'm sure it'll be a really exciting one for you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. I really hope that you found it useful and inspiring. If we have left any questions unanswered, or if you have any feedback or guest recommendations for future series, then please make sure you get in touch on info@jbmc.co.uk. I often get asked by listeners how you can help us spread the word about 40 Minute Mentor. There are two simple ways you can help. Firstly, share this episode on your preferred social media platform, and LinkedIn is probably where I'm most likely to see it. And you can also leave us a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Every share on social media and review left on the podcast platforms really helps us to get 40 Minute Mentor in front of new audiences and share the power of mentorship even further. Thank you so much for your ongoing support, and I look forward to seeing you again next Wednesday for even more pocket-sized mentorship.